Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hey guys, it's Todd. I need your help to keep my podcast free to download with minimal ads. I need you to take a short survey, and it's totally anonymous. It takes no more than 5 minutes, and there are two easy ways to begin the survey. Go to www.podcastone.com/mysurvey, or go to www.podcastone.com and click on the survey banner. If you filled out a survey in the past, thank you so much, but we still need you to do it again. You do all of us at Producers Guide and Podcast One a huge favor by filling it out. So thank you for supporting my program and for taking the time to complete the survey.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood, right here on The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
People talk about handling rejection a lot in the movie business, and if you really want to do this job for a living, you really do have to be able to handle rejection. When I first got in the business, the thing that was talked about most was actors handling rejection, you know, going out on auditions and not getting the part and having to like just sort of not internalize it and take it personally and keep moving. Producers also need to be able to handle an enormous amount of rejection. You would think when you were first in the business that the rejection would be a greater part of your life. And overcoming that rejection would be able to help you move up the ladder. But as you get more and more and more successful, and as you get more inventory and you have more projects, the amount of rejection that you have to handle on a daily basis increases exponentially. So for somebody like me who has a lot of projects in various phases of development and in pre-production and production, and rejection is not just a daily occurrence, but honestly an hourly occurrence. You have to be able to overcome all of the feelings that come with somebody saying no to you constantly. And so whether it's you're trying to get a piece of material and you can't get the piece of material, you're trying to get the writer you want, they say no. And then you get a script from the writer you want and it's terrible. Or the actor that you want that's going to make the movie get greenlit or your television show get greenlit passes. So every day there's these hurdles that you have to get over. And as you do it and as you kind of get deeper and deeper into it, you find that even though your skin is getting thicker, it's just as hard every day to kind of gear up and be able to do it on a day-to-day basis. But I will say sometimes rejection and sometimes a project not going forward can actually lead to something that you would want and you didn't even know you want. So maybe an actor passes and then a better actor comes on that you would never have thought would have been great for the role, or a movie's about to go and it doesn't go for some reason. And that opens up another opportunity for you to even do a project that's better. And that certainly is the case with my next guest, Jim Rash. He and his partner, Nat Faxon, had a movie that they were very passionate about. They wrote it and they were taken down the line so many different times with this project and held on to it and really nurtured it and cared for it and really wanted to get it made. And they got to almost to the starting line so many times with it. And one particular time they got to the starting line, it was just soul crushing for them. So they decided, you know what, we're going to take a break. We're not going to let anybody else but us make this movie. In the meantime, while they were taking a break and not pushing forward their movie, they were called in for a little movie called The Descendants, which they got the job to write and they won the Academy Award. My next guest is Jim Rash. Enjoy. All right, I'm here with Jim Rash. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
You have a new movie called Bernard and Huey that's out right now. I saw it. It's fantastic.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
But before we get to that, I want to say in the most Hollywood inside way, you and I worked out at the same gym.
Okay.
In Brentwood.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I can't remember what it was called because I stopped and you clearly didn't.
Wait, was it? Oh, yes. No, Velocity.
Velocity. Do you still work out there?
Yeah.
You're in great shape.
Thank you.
And proven by the movie Bernard and Huey, which you haven't seen it. When you read that script, did it start every scene, Bernard, his shirt off?
Yeah.
Because you literally, first of all, I could never do that movie. Your shirt is off 90% of the movie, and you are banging
90%.
Girls like left and right in that movie.
This is close. Yeah, I look for scripts that just say get your shirt.
Yeah, because you look great. Yeah, you obviously stayed with it. I did not.
Okay,
stay with it.
All right,
I've come back. Nope, I've given up.
Nope. All right, that's fine. All right, let's just let it go. I'm not gonna fight.
But I love that movie because it's such a great take on a reversal. You know, you start off with being friends one way, and then in present day you flipped, and then he's slowly trying to grind you back to where you were as a child. Tell us about how that movie got made.
Yeah. Well, Bernard and Huey is actually based on two characters that were created in a comic strip, actually, in The Village Voice back in like...
Jules Pfeiffer,
yeah,
right?
Jules Pfeiffer. And he actually wrote this, you know, film adaptation of these two characters in like 1986, and it's been sitting on the shelves obviously since.
How did somebody find it? They just knew the cartoon and
no, the character of the director, Dan Mirvish,
playing the director today,
who is one of the founders of Slam Dance, and his and Jules, and just happened that Jules' daughter, I don't know her, I can't remember her name, had a film there. A few years back, I'm guessing. And that's how it all started.
Wow.
Dan had talked to her about Jules, and somehow he knew of the script that had sat around forever. So basically, this is a version of Bernard and Huey played by myself, and David Koechner plays Huey. And it's just two men in the midlife crisis, you know, and they were friends when they were in college age. And, you know, Huey was this womanizer, and Bernard was this sort of nerd trying to figure out women. And then 30 years later, they're sort of estranged, and Huey pops up in his life, and 30 years of absence between each other, and their lives have changed. But then it's how, you know, you pick up with old friends, and either for positive or negative reasons, they bring out the best or worst in you. So these are two not great men, you know? They're
well,
flawed.
You end up sleeping with his daughter.
I end up sleeping with Mae Whitman.
And he ends up sleeping with your ex-girlfriend and one of your coworkers.
Exactly. So it is men behaving really badly, and then the smarter women around them who are trying to fix anything that they can.
Which is just exactly like real life.
Yes.
So you grew up in North Carolina?
Yeah. I grew up in Charlotte, yeah.
You still have a little bit of Southern twang.
It's in there, yeah.
and you, I had the Nobodies guys and gal on.
Oh, yeah.
They're amazing.
Love them.
And you're like, you know, jealousy is a great motivator because you're part of their story.
I was part of their story, yes.
Your Academy Award just incensed them to actually go crazy.
Incensed them to decide to do a show about their other friends. Yeah. No, we all came to the Groundlings exactly the same time.
And was that your first thing that you had done, like, in the business, in quotes?
What do you mean, like the...
I mean, as an actor, as a writer, the Groundlings, was that your first...
Yes,
Had you done anything? Like, I know you were in Sky High, you played...
That was all pre...
You played amateur porn guy in One Hour Photo.
I was in One Hour Photo.
Your list of credits. You have, like, amateur porn guy, and then there's another one that was really funny. There was, like, another one that was that's the title of it was very funny. It was something like that.
Yeah, it's probably all the same. I think, it's like,
But had you done acting before you were in the Groundlings, or was that your first?
Yeah, well, you know, I did certainly, you know, all the way back to high school was, you know, sort of in love.
When did you know that you wanted to do this?
I pretty much knew at the very least college, mm-hmm. if not in high school, had aspirations to if that was possible. But in college, I knew that I was going to come out to Los Angeles at the end.
And your first idea was to be an actor?
Yes. I hit the ground running sort of same. I had waited tables all through college, so prepping for that, waited tables once I got out here, and did the whole headshot, mailing, everything. So yes, sort of focused on acting. And then I heard about the Groundlings pretty much maybe months into landing in LA, just, you know, and went to see a show, and then I was like, this sounds right for me, and got into the school there and was there for 4 years until I finally, you know, through the school program, and then pretty much got in. So I think writing for me really took off because of the Groundlings, as far as doing it on a constant basis. So that
and
was
your
like graduate
cast,
school.
And your class was incredible.
Crazy. It we was, had, I mean,
new,
I was,
that's where you met Nat.
I met Nat. Nat and Fax and I were in together. We were also at the same time with Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy. And then obviously the whole Nobodies creators, Rachel Ramirez and Hugh Davidson, Larry Dorff, and many others.
It's great.
It's crazy.
That's a great, just being thrown into the fire. It's great.
Yeah.
And that's where you started writing?
I think for the most part, we in the sense of like almost like a graduate school, we were writing. Obviously, at the Groundlings, you write all the material you perform. And then Nat and I, you know, sort of, you know, you write with everybody, mm-hmm. but then some, you find people that you write easiest with and you sort of gravitate towards them. And Nat and I were having at least seemed like an easy time for him to sit on the couch while I typed. But so he did well. And then we just said, let's write, you know, a TV pilot. So we stumbled our way into like trying to write a pilot.
What was the first pilot?
The pilot we wrote. Ultimately, actually, got made. It was called Adopted. It was done at ABC way
back
when.
And that's a show that where you, was it you starring?
No.
The lead character finds out that he's adopted as an adult. You're adopted, right?
Yes, I am adopted.
Was that based on your real life?
Yes. Not based on the real life of my biological parents showing up like they do in the pilot. It was inspired because my sister is also adopted different biological parents, and her mother had tracked her down. So we sort of went off of that idea. And we shot the pilot, in like 2005, I think.
Wow.
And obviously didn't go past pilot stage, but... it's a crazy experience.
That's amazing. Well, that's been a big theme throughout this podcast with everybody, is just having to do it yourself. Cannot wait. I mean, you've been in hundreds. You're also a voiceover artist.
Do some voiceover.
Tons of voiceover. Yeah. Believe me, I grew up listening to your voice because my son, who's 17, listened to all the Disney stuff, all the pirates and all the shows that you've done, your voiceover work. Now my daughter's 10, same thing. And you don't wait. You don't wait for you're making your own way too, as a writer, as a voiceover artist, as an actor. You're not just sitting back waiting for roles to come. You're actually going out and creating your own stuff.
I think you're in a stage where you need to be generating your own stuff or pounding. It's just like it's a different, especially with this. Even when I got out here pre YouTube, pre any of this stuff that had sort of a platform for that, I realized pretty early it's about doing it yourself in certain ways. I mean, The Way, Way Back, which is the movie that, we did in 2013 or whatever, that was an 8-year experience of trying to, and then ultimately just saying, we're going to do it ourselves.
Well, I want to talk about that. Yeah. And I also want to talk about The Descendants. In terms of your feature/TV writing career, can you walk me through the order of those things? The first thing was adopted?
The first thing we did was adopted. And then at the same sort of simultaneous time, we started what would become The Way, Way Back, very early stages.
And that was based on your life or Nat's?
It was inspired by a moment in my life as far as the opening scene of the screenplay. The moment in the car that's in the movie, and Steve Carell is asking, our character of Duncan, what he thinks he is on a scale from 1 to 10. And Duncan says he's a 6. And he says, I think you're a 3. And here's why. So that, if you took all the lines and you transported me back to me and my stepfather, you would watch that exact same scene in a station wagon headed towards, we would spend our summers on Lake Michigan. And this was our second summer going there, and he had that conversation with me.
And that inspired the rest of the movie, relationship with him and kind of how you blossomed over that summer.
Yes, it was sort of taking a very dramatic-sounding moment for a coming-of-age story, and then how that advice, as hard as it is to hear, or let's say tactless sort of approach to it, changed him for the better, right. As far as like the summary had. So yes, when we started, because we had written Adopted, and we were like, oh, let's do a real broad thing in a water park. So we started, writing that. And then I told him that story, and then that sort of took over. And then we realized.
Why a water park? Do you have some connection to it?
It's same thing. We just had a fondness for growing up and water parks, especially when I was we would go to it's so cheesy, but Myrtle Beach and beaches, some of the North Carolina beaches. And there was this, every other block there was another water park.
Right.
And so, even though the beach is so close, we would go there.
Well, no, but it's such great advice because you, when you're starting out, you have to write what you know.
Yes.
I mean, if you really want to, be authentic and be good, very few people can just wake up and write a Marvel movie.
No.
Most people, when they start writing, write about their own experiences. Clearly, you did that in spades. And so that was the first script you wrote, and you thought, you must have thought, we'll send this out. Mm-hmm. It'll be like Adopted. We'll get it made.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. it'll be so easy breezy. If anything, if Adopted tells anything,
right.
it's usually just, your first shot.
Yeah, right? I mean, we're one for one.
Well, wait. So this is easy breezy. So, yeah. Yes. And then 8 years later, you're like, see? Easy breezy.
Yes, exactly. And 8 is not unheard of.
No.
Eight's pretty good.
We did pretty good. I think Little Miss Sunshine, I'm probably wrong, was like 11. I don't know.
We're under the bar there.
We're under the bar.
So did you send it out to a bunch of people and then it was summarily rejected? How did that go?
Its long road wasn't so much based on rejection as much as it is on the difficulties of just getting a movie going. So I think our, it started with a manager reading, go, I love this, or something. And it felt like it was going to have this really fast track. Mm-hmm. At the time, Sean Levy had gotten a hold of it. Sean Levy directs, you know, Night Museum
and produces
and produces tons of stuff. So, and Stranger Things, mm-hmm. obviously, is his too as producer. So he got a hold of it, and he really wanted to direct The Way, Way Back in between times we had, because he thought this would be a nice small movie to do. But he had a timeline before Night at the Museum 2 started. So that was one of those things where he started the process and then it just didn't come together fast enough. So he gave it back to us because he was obviously off on another.
Did you talk
adventure.
Casting at all at that point?
He had already started. You know, he was looking for all those leads for various things, and it would have been a very different, you know, cast. It's
right.
just the way it is. But it didn't come together. So then we went through Peyton, who else? Tom Pazuka, who directed Family Stone, was going to do it for a while. Many other directors, mm-hmm. you know, tried or we went
And
to.
Was it set up anywhere? It was
at that moment he had a thing with Fox Searchlight, and mm-hmm. Fox Searchlight ended up giving it back to us after Sean dropped out. And then I think it was Mandate, I think we went and took a little journey with. And then ultimately, basically what happened was someone along the way said, you know, we'll make this movie. But here are your options for Owen. Now, Owen in the movie that we did was played by Sam Rockwell, who's amazing. That was always our vision for it. One, Sam Rockwell idea, but also that age range. Their idea was to go much younger, and they had pitched to us two actors who were great, but it didn't feel right to us. It was like Zac Efron and I think Ashton Kutcher at the time, you know, who I think obviously made it financially make sense to mm-hmm. them. So we had two options. One, make that movie that with those guys, nothing wrong with that, or wait basically almost 2 more years until it's out of turnaround or whatever and free mm-hmm. and back in our hands. So we decided to wait and make it the way we wanted to make it.
Wow.
How we envisioned Owen, age range wise, for sure. And so we just sort of put it to the side, and this is where the Descendants sort of chapter happened. But anyway, so, you know.
So okay, it's important to interject this. So now.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is not the only thing you've been working on for 8 years. You've been acting, and you know, were you writing other things at the time? Were you writing television, or were Nat and you? Because I've worked with Nat. Were you both acting?
I'm sorry.
At that point? And he's great.
No, of course.
And he was awesome. And what was great about it at the time, we did the Zookeeper together. What was great about the time was Descendants was just getting made,
mm-hmm.
so it was so much fun to watch him go, yeah, you know, I think this thing's going to get made with. It's so weird with Clooney. And it's like, mm-hmm. this thing's kind of getting a life. And I only knew him as an actor. So I was just stunned that he had written this thing that was on
We're
the blacklist.
We're all stunned.
And
I'm stunned every day that I look at him.
And to defend Nat, if I was a writer, I would have to sit on the couch and just talk.
No.
I would need to write with a partner.
Yes.
I could never just sit there and do it by myself.
It has every benefit you can imagine. There's every reason to do it and every reason sometimes not to do it.
Hey, before we keep going with Jim, let me tell you about TrueCar. Most people think TrueCar is just for buying new cars. Well, that's not true. They are now just as good at selling used cars. And with their certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, that's right, 1 million, you'll enjoy real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler buying experience, whether you buy new or used. And with TrueCar, users can see what others paid. See, that's how it works. You go and you get a range of what others paid around the dealers that you want to go to, and you'll know if you're getting the best deal before buying. They're also more likely to enjoy a faster buying experience by connecting with TrueCar certified dealers. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, check out TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features may not be available in all states.
Everyone's favorite housewife is back, and she's ready for round two. Step into Heather Dubrow's world now twice a week on Podcast One.
I loved it.
Heather's bringing you more of what you love, like YouTube's Glow Zell.
And now you got a beautiful, healthy
yes.
little
yes, she's
girl
healthy.
Who's going to hate you in 13 years.
Right.
And you're going to go, do you know how much I paid for you?
Roll the tape. Roll the tape.
Do you see?
Check out Heather Dubrow's world every Thursday and Friday at Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. Also, remember to rate and review.
Hello, this is Adam Rifkin. Sometimes people call me Riff Coogan, and you're listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
So during these 8 years, now you decide to put this on the shelf for 2 years so that you guys can do it your way, which is admirable and great because the movie's great, and I love Sam. I just
Yes.
Saw him last night. Leslie Bibb is in my movie, so we were hanging out last night. Yes. He's great, not to name drop, but anyway. So,
we picked them both up. We have to pick them up.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So how did you find that book? How did you guys find it?
Well, what happened was, as we're in high, you know, on hold with Way, Way Back, but at the time it then becomes sort of, you know, it becomes almost like a sample for you. It's not made, but it's out and around town. And Alexander Payne and his producing partner, Jim Burke, and obviously Jim Taylor, his writing partner, had a company at the time called Ad Hominem, and they had optioned The Descendants, written. And so they had read The Way, Way Back. So they brought us in because they were meeting with writers trying to find someone who was going to react to the book and adapt it. So obviously we read the book and loved it and went in to have a meeting with them as far as like our approach and that kind of stuff.
It's important also to just say that is so key what you just said, because writing a script never will not pay off. Just in your growth as a writer, learning what to do next, learning what not to do the next time, but also it lives and it's out there, and that because of that thing that could be perceived as a quote unquote failure, you're getting the job of your life at this point.
Yes,
as a sample.
As a sample. So what does feel like crushing in the sense that something's not going to be made at the time, it is going to open some kind of door, you know, based on it, whether it's right to be made now or not. So that got us in the door with those guys. Then we got the job, obviously, and so this became another, you know, substantial journey, mainly because we wrote the first draft and then the strike happened, the writer's strike that was like 100 days lasting. So we was like pens down and we had just turned it in, so we couldn't, you know, technically get notes or anything, so we just sort of sat and you know, walked the picket lines and waited.
And were you acting at the time also? Were you TV stuff?
I'm trying to remember where.
It's also confusing because you also did a voice in The Descendants.
I did?
Didn't you?
No.
Oh, I thought I saw that on your resume.
I wish.
What is the pirate show?
I was the woman in a coma's voice. You didn't hear it.
What is the pirate's voice? No. The Descendants is a Disney show.
Descendants.
Yes, that's what's always confusing to me. My kids watch The Descendants, which is a Disney show.
Okay,
which
now
is
I'm
the Descendants of all the villains.
Yes.
In the high
wish
school.
I had done a voice.
But you did put the pirates, the Neverland Pirates. Did you do a voice?
I did a guest thing on that.
You've got a long resume.
Well, thank you.
I was going through it. I'm like, there's no way I'm going to be able to remember all this.
I wish. Yeah. I love the idea that it was a voice.
So now it's pens down. Are you acting during the writing, or you're just in it?
I don't remember. Timeline-wise, I'm trying to remember when Community started in relation to all those things.
Because that's really – I mean, you were also in Mike Mitchell's movie, Sky High.
Yes.
I love Mike Mitchell. I gave him his first movie. Just off his short with the alien puppet, I just think he's amazing. Right. And now he obviously has this huge career. It was great. It was a great movie. I liked that movie a lot.
Yeah. Sky High was so much fun.
Was Sky High or Community the thing that you think you're really kicked you off into, as an actor?
Well, I think it's interesting because I think Sky High is one of those ones that everyone has seen, you know. But I think and Community, but I think. I think probably Community, just in the sense of the, as far as a television show with longevity, you know, that's the longest show I've ever been on. And so I would probably say that, you know.
You're definitely most recognized.
The last episode of Friends probably for up until then was probably number one as far as a few people might have seen
that. Yes, that was a good one.
but yes, definitely Community is on an acting thing.
So now there's a writer's strike. You're walking the picket line.
Walking the picket line and we're waiting.
And then it ends.
And then it ends, and so we finally get notes. And so, you know, your first draft, especially when we were learned by doing on adapting a novel, it was way too – I mean, it was epic. It was like, might as well just handed the book over and said, we finished, you know, done. You know, we took out a couple things. So it felt like we had just done this epic thing. And so we got great notes from Alexander and them. And it was pretty much one, as you would imagine, really find the movie inside this book, but also put yourselves into it. So
you
know, inject it a little bit. So it gave us a little bit of freedom and understanding to attack the second draft. Mark will be different. And then at the time, again, Alexander was busy writing what was downsized at the time. Would become downsized. And so he wasn't planning to direct it. So we met with Stephen Frears at the time, who was going to tackle it. So we went to New York and spent a day with Stephen Frears. And
Descendants or Downsized?
Descendants.
All right, sorry.
So we went with...
he's great.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I met High Fidelity with him.
Oh.
He's so amazing.
We spent a day with him in New York and, you know, in a room and got his notes and then sort of tackled his, you know, his thoughts on the second draft.
What's amazing about him... Stephen Frears, is that it's like Tiger Woods' golf swing. Mm-hmm. There's no wasted movement with that guy. He just, everything he says is so point on point. No wasted movement. He's so calm. Mm-hmm. And he's just such a pro. It was really fascinating to watch.
I bet.
Watch him direct.
It was, we had a day with him. And from what I saw, it was great.
Yeah.
Ultimately, obviously, he did not end up doing it. He went to do something else. And I think he grappled with understanding Hawaii really well.
Right.
You know, I think it was he felt like he needed to understand Hawaii better. You know,
did you have an affinity for Hawaii at all?
You know, we went and visited. My first time going was when we were writing the first draft. You know, because we had spoken with Cowie Hart Hemmings, who wrote the book, but mainly just to experience and see all the stuff that's in the book quite vividly.
You captured it great.
Well, thank you. Well, that's I think, you know, ultimately, obviously, Alexander put Downsize to the side because it was, you know, a pretty epic movie and a large budget. And he really wanted to direct it in 6 years since Sideways. So he pretty much turned his attention on the Descendants. We met with him. He read all the drafts and obviously the book, and then we just sort of chatted out our versions, why we did this, what about this scene, how about this character, move this here. And then he took a pass, and then ultimately the collection of that is what you see on the screen. And so really, you know, obviously as the director, he has this benefit. He went and spent so much time in Hawaii in pre-production and really wanted to inject, you know, both – you know, what you see, and also with actors who were really Hawaiian and obviously throughout the movie, everything just, you know, sort
came
of
together.
comes together.
When you were going through that process of meeting Stephen Frears and the different directors, did you have as much invested in as you did it as the way back? And did it feel the same because it was an assignment, or did you kind of feel a little bit like, well, it's Alexander's thing and I'm just really trying to deliver?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is a different type of job, you know. Mm-hmm. Certainly when you're going back the way back, even when, you know, Sean was going to direct it for a while, you were a writer and you're watching your thing be passed on. Mm-hmm. You know, this was same, but different in the sense that, you know, there was a vested, you know, there was obviously people were going to take it off and we went and visited, but it's like, you know, thank you.
Right.
We're done with you.
Right.
So I don't think we really realized how different it would be until, you know, we finally got back to the way back, which was after the Oscars.
Did you sit on set at all and watch Alexander direct?
Like 5 days.
Did you glean something from that? Were you watching it with that eye? Like, we're doing this.
Maybe with the hope that we would do this, but more like we definitely watched this process because we went for 5 days. They were on Kauai at the time, and we were there, just happened to be there the day in the movie where they were shooting the scene between George Clooney and Matthew Lillard, mm-hmm. which is obviously he's confronting the guy who's had an affair, and in this little bungalow. And so the bungalows are super tiny. So everyone's outside, save for Alexander and the actors and a small set of crew. So we're all, Nat and I are hovered around the sound cart, you know, looking at a little tiny screen on that and listening. But it was really cool just to, I mean, not obviously Alexander is probably not the only, but he does, at least from what I watched, sit on the side, you know, of the camera. And you can just sort of hear him talking to the actor in between these moments, you know, mm-hmm. he's right up there with them. You know, he's not off in the tent or anything.
Yeah.
He's right in there. So it was really cool to see.
Yeah, that's a good. I know a lot of directors that do that. He was sitting right there.
So he just wanted to watch.
That's great.
He wanted to watch it live.
So super intimate.
Yes,
that's awesome. And so, when did you start to feel the momentum of that awards buzz, and then start to feel like, holy crap, this is going to happen?
I think
I talked to Sam about it last night too.
Oh yeah,
Rockwell. Yeah. And I said, because that's never going to happen to me. So I was like,
we don't know what.
We don't know
tomorrow. We do not know tomorrow.
So I was like, what is the process like? What is going through it? Because it's got. He says, first of all, it's like slow motion, mm-hmm. and then it becomes slow motion fueled by adrenaline. So walk me through. It's made. Did you go to the previews? I'm assuming you saw the movie. Did you start to feel like, holy mackerel?
I think it certainly started to change, really focus, I think, once he got Clooney aboard pre-, pre-even shooting it. Then when you were there, you felt something. And then when you finally saw it, you were like, this seems like something very special and very throwback, which is very Alexander, you know. Mm-hmm. I think most of his movies feel like throwback in the best possible way. And I think he would say the same thing as far as the movies he grew up on. Because he always talks about that growing up and seeing movies of the 70s. But I don't know if you can ever anticipate exactly, you know, what the idea of being nominated is going to be, or a reality or not.
Speaking of throwbacks, what were the movies that influenced you the most growing up?
John Hughes, in the sense that I grew up on watching John Hughes. I was that age, you know, during Breakfast Club and all those things. So obviously that can't not resonate with you. And it's a big part of what The Way Way Back is, would be for us. Very throwback, you know. And coming of age obviously is a timeless type of story, because there's so many coming of age stories, because we all come of age. The one thing we have in common in some fashion. But I would say John Hughes. I mean, later, you know, this would have been – beginning 1990 or 1 it came out. Raising Arizona was big one for me. I
love that movie so much.
I think camera stuff changed for me there. And I know that's not the one that people will go, well, there's lots of stuff. But for some reason hit me as a college
kid. And just
the
structure of it. Yeah. I was lucky enough to work with the Coen brothers on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou later, and Clooney later. But I saw Raising Arizona by myself in a theater. And it starts, and you're like, okay, well, I'm in. And there's no credits. And then you're going along, and then that opening happens. Yes. I levitated out of my seat when that happened.
This is not the correct time, but around 11 minutes to something for that intro.
Yes.
Before you see Raising Arizona and that iconic now music that plays right at that moment. Everything about it sort of blew my mind.
Me
because
too.
I hadn't heard that tone before, just the off-camera weird talking while Holly Hunter's taking the picture, you know, which is very like Simpsons now, you know, to have all these off-camera things, just yelling stuff in, you know. I don't know. It's just something different for me.
Me too. So what now do you think, just to look ahead, what as an artist, what do you think people now are being influenced by? Like, what would you think the movies now, the kids are going to be like, well, you know, I wrote this movie because I was super influenced by the Avengers and Star Wars. I mean, it feels Star Wars was obviously massive for me too, but it just feels like those movies, like The Way, Way Back, the John Hughes 16 Candles, those, you know, Stripes is a big one for me, Raising Arizona. It feels like all that's on streaming and television now. And it's an interesting time in the movies, because those iconic experiences I had as a teenager sitting with a bunch of my buddies watching Stripes is not really happening.
Yeah, it's hard to say, because it's like every now and then something peeks through. I mean, I'd say all of a sudden a Rushmore appears, all of a sudden Lady Bird appears, and I think everyone gets subjected, whatever age range made all these things happen. I think those movies do continue to influence people later. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously we're in an age where, you know, superheroes and certain comedies and marketing books that have a familiar title is sort of at the press, you know, sort of at the forefront of some of that stuff. But then you'll have these surprises that I think, I think TV helps to also like still tell stories that might feel a little bit more throwback too. So luckily, I think there's enough out there that you know might inspire different storytellers.
So during the whole awards process, which is long, what was like the most memorable? Obviously, you won the Academy Award and you won the Golden Globe. But just in terms of that process, what resonates with you? What do you think about
all
of it? I mean, is it the Academy winning that? Sam doesn't remember winning it. He's just like it's a blur.
I don't.
What's the most memorable moment of that awards season for you?
There's so many moments where you'll have those out-of-body experience, you know. I think, the first thing is when you get nominated, then you have a sort of finite amount of stuff I think you can do campaign-wise. In other words, you can do a certain number of panels, you can do a certain number, you know, like that or however the rules work. So, you know, we would go off and do certain panels alone, you know, like Nat would do something, then I'd do one. And I remember going to panels and just enjoying that process of sitting next to the other writer nominees and hearing about their – I'm always interested talked about writers. So yeah. I was interested to hear, because I think at the time I was sitting, I believe that was the year, it was like 50-50 or in Beginners. There was two, I was listening to those screenwriters talking about, you know, writing about personal stories and what that feels like and how how it's difficult, you know, to write about your family in such a way that they're going to see it, you know. And both of them talked about writing about their subsequent parental figures, you know, one was post their passing or whatever, and telling those stories. So I love that moment. The other one, obviously, is the out-of-body experience of actually winning, obviously, and going up on stage. And
did you watch it back? Have you watched it? Recently,
but no, that night, yes. That's I mean, awesome. It's crazy. Yeah, because you don't, I mean, you do and you don't, you know. Obviously, when we got up there, Alexander was going to sort of, you know, they tell you, even though no one obeys this, but they tell you only one speaker, you know, for multiple winners. So Alexander was going to take lead, you know, and Nat and I don't know, you know, got up there and made it a moment.
Good.
Did a bit.
Good.
And then... and then the last part, you know, going backstage, you know, you're going through this little, you know, reporters and stuff, but then you do these photos. And we just happened to win very soon after, I think, Meryl had won. So I think we were right behind her waiting for her to take pictures. I don't even think I said a word to her, but the fact that I was standing next to her and we're like...
Holding an Academy Award.
We're getting pictures together. Not together, but we're near.
Holding an Academy Award.
Holding an Academy Award.
It's amazing. Did now your life change instantly the next day?
I don't know if instantly. I mean, I think certainly that opens doors and conversations, but you still have to go in and get the job, or you still have to have the great idea. So I feel like, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, you can write whatever. Right. But I think that what comes with that is an invitation to walk in, and then hopefully you'll leave and impress them. But that's only to say, oh, yeah, we'll talk to you.
And you do realize now, you're out of the two scripts you've written, you won an Academy Award already for
yes,
one.
So yes.
Your stats are still pretty.
It's okay. Yes, it's doing
good.
Fine. It's
and
doing
you,
good.
And you actually bat 100 because you actually do get the way back made. So it's like
yes, we got it made. So
you're Hall of Fame now.
So
right?
far, yeah. So maybe I should just stop. That's it. So I'll have a great amazing. Stats for the rest of my life.
Did the next day the way back suddenly take a little bit of a turn?
Very soon after.
Okay.
We waited that time. So this was fortuitous that it all fell apart, and then we waited that time, and it allowed us, yes, to open that door, which meant we were going to do another year and a half of pounding the pavement to find the money to do it.
Right.
But we were able to, I think, convince, you know, enough people to say, but we're directing this. Because I think we realized, let's just do it ourselves the way we want to do it.
Right. And so you realize now, after being an actor and a writer for so long, going back to the groundlings, writing your own stuff, doing your own thing, making your own way. You're going to produce this now. I mean, you know, in every sense of the word.
Yes, we had met. It's a friend of Nat's, or they had a mutual friend's, Kevin Walsh, and it was the three of us basically in our little offices in Santa Monica. And he's amazing and just one of those guys who remembers every single person and is charming. And he just sort of started pounding the pavement saying, we're going to make this, you know. And that was a year and a half later, we were. So while that seems like a long amount of time, the whole time you're just sort of focused on one thing, which is we're going to make this, make it our way. We're going to get the cast that we think is correct. And speaking of Sam, just to say that story is, you know, we always had Sam Rockwell in mind, you know, because this was our Bill Murray, you know, growing up on Meatballs. And so the script had gotten to him. We got a call that he was interested. He wanted to talk about it. So Nat and I are in the car at the time we were making the call, we were driving through Los Angeles, and we're like in our minds, we're going to pull over and we got to prep. We got to be ready because he was in New York. And, you know, we got to, you know, convince him that, you know, we're actors. You know, we spend a lot of time on set, you know, we're, you know, blah, 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 you know, whatever.
We have an Academy Award.
Academy Award. If that does anything, hopefully it does. But everything else is just like, we won't shit the bed, hopefully.
You just keep saying stuff like, you know, we're descendants of.
When I didn't talk to Clooney on the set of The Descendants, when Clooney didn't.
You know what George always says?
You know what George always says? I heard he always says. Our good friends. So we pull over and he answers the phone, of course. And he's like, hey, guys. And we're like, hey.
That's a great Sam Rockwell.
Thank you. Hey, guys. Hey, what's up? It's sort of like it's like Bill Murray, Meatballs, right? Yeah, it's great. Yeah. let's do this. It was that fast. It was like not shouldn't happen this way.
Isn't that great?
And so then we're sort of stumbling because in our minds we're like, get off the phone.
Yeah.
It's done. We don't mess this up.
Right.
But then he just starts talking about, do you guys like to improv? You know, I love that. And you, that's it. It was the most simple thing you could ever imagine. And they're not, you know, that many wonderful people like Sam Rockwell, who's genuinely a good person.
Amazing.
And a talent. But yeah, that began it all. So we had Sam and then Allison Janney were probably the first two.
I mean, that in Hollywood parlance, it's called actor bait.
Yeah.
Like when you get two actors like that, everybody else just feels completely, this is going to be fun.
Yes.
It's going to be great working with this level of actors.
No.
It's always great when that happens.
Yes. It was absolutely a strategy that people should do use, but it's sort of like so-and-so and so-and-so. And so,
yep.
All right, that brings, obviously, in the business, someone that will push you over that money edge, you know, is certainly a last piece you need. For us, you know, we had Tony Collette. We had everything in place except for one piece left, which was, you know, we went after Steve Carell.
Had you done The Office by this point?
The what?
You were on The Office by this point?
No.
Community.
I was Community.
Sorry.
Yes, I was doing Community.
I get those two confused all the time, and it's ridiculous.
We were on the same night, at some point.
It's stupid, but yeah. I do all the time.
No. Yes, I was definitely on. I was on Community all through Descendants stuff and into the way, way back. But we called Steve Carell. He read it, really liked it, but he ultimately passed because he spends his summers. That's a big thing from his family summer. Right?
In Maine, right?
In Massachusetts.
I cannot get one thing right today.
It feels like you don't know anything.
I don't know anything about the business
today.
The
two most important things you need to know are
Massachusetts.
I was not on Office.
That's right.
And Steve Carell is in Massachusetts.
I was close. Same night and northeast.
And we have a lot of things. A lot of things worked.
I'm really failing today.
No, you know, you get one more and then I leave.
Well, you're intimidating me with your Academy Award.
Oh, please. Oh, yes. Yeah.
And you brought it in today, which is so
bizarre. How dare
you?
I bring it everywhere. Why wouldn't you? It's okay, sir. It's okay, sir. I call it sir too. So I, his agent, to her credit, called us and said,
Michelle Bohan.
Yeah, Michelle Bohan.
I got one right.
You did. Okay, now I'm back. And it's the third M, so it really works out. Michelle called us in and said, you know, unfortunately, he spends the summers, not unfortunately, but said he spends the summer. That's a big thing for him. She says, I think it was a soft no. So maybe you call. Have you ever thought about Massachusetts? You know, because we were going to shoot it. You know, we could shoot in North Carolina at that time. They still had a good
rebate.
So did Massachusetts. So we were like, yeah, it just needed to be East Coast in our minds. That, you know, that's the, we both grew up there. So, and Nat grew up in Massachusetts. And so basically we write him a letter and basically say, what if we shoot this where you vacation?
Right.
And the next thing you know, he's doing the movie and we're shooting literally in Green
your
Harbor.
Kids to the water park.
Everybody did.
That's so great.
People rode bikes to set.
Yep.
It's so small. We all stayed. And the town couldn't love Steve more and then they couldn't love us more. They were just one of those things where you fall into the best possible place to shoot a movie.
This is what Sandler does. Honestly, he considers that when he makes his decisions about where to shoot, is that he understands that everybody's bringing their family and everybody's uprooting, and he makes it as fun as humanly possible. He, you know, we shot a bunch of stuff in Boston, but he shot all the grown-ups out there, and he would just build a camp for everybody.
Yeah, we shot that in the same water park as grown-ups.
Yeah, and I went the 3 days they were shooting there, and we had a blast.
Yeah.
He had all the kids there, everybody, and he throws them in the movie because he understands that everybody's making a huge sacrifice.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah.
What a fun experience.
We shot in the exact same place, yes. Little
so
mom
great.
And pop, wonderful.
Did you make other people just stay by the sound cart while you and Nat just stayed by the camera?
Yeah. Like, or we might have been by the sound cart.
This is the way Alexander did it, and so we're doing it that way.
We're doing it
everybody else
way.
Get by this one.
And the actor's like, yeah, you need to get out of my eyesight.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'll go behind the mouth.
I mean, this is what Alexander and George... We'll do it your way.
That's what we do. That's what we do. I think we did it. We did it a couple of times in smaller areas. But the water park. Oh my God, that's, you know, we didn't. Unlike I think grown-ups, probably we couldn't pay to shut it down. We could never pay what they lose, what they would make in a day,
right?
Because it's literally a water park that's open.
It's massive.
It's massive. But in that area, I mean, it's open maybe May to early August ish.
It gets so cold.
It starts getting cold.
Right.
So they make all of their money in this short amount of time. And there was days where, you know, there was 600 people there, wow. I would imagine, you know, buses and buses. Makes us look like we afforded the most background in the world. But, man, it's
challenging.
Our poor sound people.
Yeah, I mean, I've shot in malls that had to stay open. I've shot in all kinds of places. The Wynn Hotel had to stay open. And we just
really?
Shot there. Yep.
Wait, in Vegas?
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's challenging, but I think it's fun, too. I mean, it's interesting when people – just because people are generally respectful.
Yeah.
They're generally not trying to screw up your shot or anything.
Right.
And they're excited to be around it. So I find that people are – I had one flash mob run through a set once. But other
really?
Than that, yeah, people are generally pretty quiet and
respectful. We did pretty good. I mean, we got a – it was hard, you know, every night.
It is Massachusetts. And they also are on vacation.
They're on vacation.
And they also are wanting to go down a specific slide. And you're like, you can't. I'm sorry.
So there are many times where well, that guy looked right into the camera. Oh, all right, there we are. Or way
is
in the back.
Flipping me off.
Yeah, that kid's waving right at us.
How many days did you shoot?
Total, we did 24, and then we all chipped in for one extra
day. Wow. You all chipped in.
Well, we had to because we got hit with rain right away. And
that is the problem with Boston in the summer.
Yes. And the water park was geniusly, we wrote a script that has no interiors in half of it.
Oh.
So the water park was, we started with water park. So we spent the first chunk there and then the rest of our cast showed up and we shot the house second. And so we got behind pretty instantly.
That's such a good point.
And you're on a call with the bond company right away.
That's such a good point. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to make a point of this. It's what you just said is we just wrote a script with no interiors. And it's so important now, I'm sure you as a filmmaker, when you're going to do it again, you're not going to do that because you need cover.
You need coverage.
Be able to pivot and be able to help yourself.
Unless you're a building on a stage where you know,
Right. Or if it's all interiors, that's fine too.
All interiors. Yeah.
But it's a great point because we, Kevin, James, and I did Zookeeper together, and obviously this is an idea that I had, and about, I want to say, 90 days, actually 90 nights in, I realized I made a classic error of just having it all nights.
Yes. Oh.
And it's animals. I was like, what the hell am I? I'm like, why didn't I just have it that he can hear the animals whenever the heck he wants? It doesn't have to be when people aren't around.
It doesn't have to be when people aren't around.
So
I know. That's hilarious.
And that was on that movie. We'd sit there and I'm sorry, guys. This is brutal.
Nights take it out of you.
It really
does. I don't care how you.
Yeah. So now when you direct your next movie, I promise you'll have some cover, I'm sure.
And also, it's just so simple. It's like, can these two people talk inside the cafeteria at the water park? Do they have to be on the top of the water slide?
Yeah, you did have a lot of stuff on the top. I remember that.
Well, there were a lot of bits with swimmers.
Down,
so, it's going down, so you didn't have anything. But, like, yes, it all did. In retrospect, it's like, they all had to be up there. But we had a couple, but very few. And it just gets you behind.
It's such a great movie.
Thank you.
I'm sure you're very proud of it. It's great.
Very proud.
I really liked it a lot. And so then post that. Now, what's happening with you as a writer, producer, director? What are you doing now? Because Bernard Huey was a great movie.
Thank you.
And you're great in it and leading man in it. So that's fantastic. But just in terms of the other stuff, what's next? What are you working on?
Well, a couple things. Nat and I have written other things. It's the same thing. No matter what you've done before, it's always going to be a challenge to get back on the train. But we were close to make. We had written this movie called The Heart, and we were going to make it with Amazon last summer. And then same sort of thing. All the cards are almost together, and then they're not together. And same sort of thing. We got the script back, and so now we're doing more way back style. So our goal is next summer to shoot that. And it's sort of just circle back to Raising Arizona. That would be, not at our version of by any means, but I'm just saying inspired by that's the movies we love. And so this is much more of a farcical sort of takes place in the black market organ trade. And it's just eclectic, weird people desiring a heart. That's it. So we hope to do that.
And it's the same team, you, Nat, and the other gentleman that's producing
Kevin will be involved. We've already... Sam, Allison.
That's so great.
And that Coen brothers have, play with the people
you
love.
Right, sure.
And they're friends and couldn't love them more. So that's the hope. And then, you know, Nat's busy right now. He's shooting the second season of his Netflix show. So, it, you know, we have to sort of circumnavigate acting moments. And then we are constantly looking at other things.
To do you, it's hard for you.
And then
guys.
we did produce one movie in the past, just came out recently, Thoroughbreds, which was this wonderful sort of dark comedy, you know, twisted. And it was written by this wonderful playwright and first-time director now, Corey Finley. And so,
how did that come to you?
Kevin Walsh, who I had mentioned, and Nat and I, and we had this little, you know, we tried a little production company type things before Kevin got a huge job working at Scott Free. Mm-hmm. So that's what he's doing now. So this play came across the desk of, you know, and then I think Kevin and they sort of ran with it, and that was it.
That's
you
great.
Know, so
that's
it's great. More Kevin's baby or whatever, and so we sort of helped with, you know, adapting the play. I mean, help, you know, Corey more than able, did not need, you know,
right.
but give notes, you know, and then also just sort of watch Corey in his first sort of week.
That's
you know, again. Didn't need us,
right.
but we were there, you know.
It's good. Well, you know what? Being additive is always great, even if they, quote-unquote, don't need you.
Well, it just seemed like, you know, he was so, like, definitive of what he wanted, and sometimes you're just sort of, but that's the good thing is, like, you sort
Absolutely.
Of trust his instincts, because you might say, you got it. All right.
Yeah. That's doing. Also another big theme that every guest has talked about is trust.
Yes.
You have between your team, between each other, between you and the actors, between you and the director as a producer, and knowing when to just back off.
Yeah. Yes,
is as much a skill as knowing when to jump in.
Yes,
and do you guys take writing assignments, or is it harder because you guys are so friggin' busy?
Yeah, I don't,
you don't want to f*** up your record by the
no.
way, because you're like, well, let's see, I've written three,
yeah.
been a pilot, and got two made, and won Academy Awards. Don't screw up my
yeah.
my
no,
nodding
you know, average. I can't. I don't want to ruin your dream. we've entertained certain things, but to be honest with you, it's we just haven't. I also don't want to. Load ourselves up too much, and plus, you know, we at the time we also had some, you know, I'd be doing Community, and then he'd be doing Married,
yeah.
and then, you know, had season of that. So I think what felt like, but we could control the best was our own material,
right.
And then we are writing this thing, a second draft of this thing called Dead Mall, which is for Fox that we pitched to them. So that's probably
right.
the first pitch that we're.
Yeah, I asked selfishly because you're on every writer's list that I have, and you're always. Listed as unavailable.
Yes, I know.
I mean, every time, because there's so many things where I would be, these guys would be perfect.
I know.
You're never available.
I think we're just, you know, it's hard when you're trying to, like, you have other aspirations.
Of course.
Things, because, you know,
so
writing it seems to take some time.
Yes, it does. So if you were to give advice to somebody young now, mm-hmm. growing up, or somebody who just wants to switch careers and become a producer, what's the best advice that you have?
One, I think it is reading lots of different scripts. You know, I think it is one is to start sort of educating yourself on what you're looking for, or what basically getting things ready
yeah.
for that kind of thing. I think.
And you can do it online now, which is so great. You used to go to Samuel French to be able to buy the scripts that you wanted to read.
What,
now you can read anything online.
Read anything.
It's great.
See what works. You know, what sold, what that kind of stuff. I guess, you know. And then, I don't know, I think proactivity is the main thing,
mm-hmm.
and whatever facet you're the most interested in,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think there's just too many opportunities now to be able to, like, shoot the smallest of things
right.
and put it somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think creating any kind of small body of work is the best calling card. It's like a script, you
yeah.
know, whether that gets made.
Yeah.
It will be
seen. What happened to you.
That yes.
got you Academy Award.
Or you look at it. Yeah. Or you look at anybody who's made something, you know, like a short film,
yeah.
like you said,
yeah.
Mitchell, and then it goes on to something bigger.
Yeah. And there's no wasted moves either. I've never done voiceover work, and I've never acted, but I would imagine all those things teach you about each craft.
Mm-hmm.
Writing obviously helps you for acting and vice versa, and I would imagine the voiceover work, just being able to try different things and inflections and
yeah.
using just dialogue as a character, I would imagine it's also helpful. So I'm always trying to encourage people that there are no wasted moves. Keep trying things, because, you know, if you're, like you said, you're right, you have a ridiculous track record, but even your track record, you wrote something you believed in, you put it off, that led to something else, you were acting in the meantime, you're doing voiceover stuff in the meantime,
mm-hmm.
you're stretching yourself in all these different ways. You started in the Groundlings, you know, and, like, your friends wrote this thing because they saw you guys can do it, so they felt they could do it too, which is great. So I think all of those things are kind of connected.
Yes, and I think there's nothing. Don't be afraid. I mean, well, I benefited just by watching. You know, anytime I had an opportunity, you know, Community, watch the Russo brothers, how they operate.
Right.
You know, or if you have an opportunity to do something that, you know, not for pay, but just to be there,
yeah,
to be on set, to be able to.
That time you were on The Office,
huh? Yeah, when I was on The Office. And I was, and that's where I met Carell.
I'll tell you, this is not the worst mistake I've ever made. I had a meeting with Paul Rudd.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I get things completely flipped around in my head. And I was like, you know, you and I have worked together before. And he's like, no, we haven't. And I go, come on. You were in Father of the Bride. And he wasn't. It was George Newbern.
That's right. Oh, my
and
God.
And he was like, no. And I'm like, oh, you're right. Yeah, no, it was George Newbern. But you guys seem very much alike. He's like, no, we don't.
Yes, no.
I go, you've never got that? He goes, no. I go, I'm going to stop talking now.
And it's just, I like that you keep doubling. Yeah, you tripled down on why you could assume that.
Exactly.
That's like, sometimes because everyone has their doppelganger or like, yes, let's say he does not agree with us. But I'm saying like, you know, you have those actors that, yes, you get mistaken for all the time. For me, it's not an actor. It's Moby. But
but that's good.
I get that all the time.
Do you, please.
And people
tell me,
get adamant that I'm lying.
Have you? Can
they'll
we,
go,
can you
really,
and I go to Ibiza?
Really, dude?
Let's you and I go to Ibiza together and get you up. Just go, you know what? My friend Moby's here. He wants to just spend. Do you mind? He just doesn't. And just look over at you and just get up there and go, I'm not.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
Or push my way through. I can't name one of my songs. Not one.
Or you know what we could do? We could make you on a drive.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go in some London thing, mm-hmm, obscure, and we'll just plug it in.
Can I just start
amazing
pushing buttons and moving my hands?
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
Most DJs do that anyway.
That is exactly what I'm going to do and get paid some big bucks. I saw him. I was very recently, it turns out we live in the same neighborhood. His vegan restaurant is not far from my area, and I've always wanted to walk into it and see if I can reprimand it. Them,
that would be amazing,
about what I heard, if he's, and then get seated and get served and you know, pay, because I would stop at that moment. I'd say I'm not Moby. I'm like a secret shopper.
That's amazing.
Like they would do when I worked at Bennigan's, and they said you might get a secret shopper.
Oh yeah,
you know, who come in and you always know it's a secret shopper because it's lunch and they have to order an alcoholic beverage and they have to order an app and they have to order a main dish and they order dessert. I'm like, it's lunch, but okay. I guess, you know, you're not
amazing.
A secret shopper.
That's amazing. Like, I do see Moby now. Now it's
do?
All I can see.
Oh, no, it's there. Especially if I have, like, a stubble, which I do. I have a weird stash. No one can see it but me, you, and yes, I can see what people think. And
great.
Our glasses are in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
That's great. Very handsome guy. So,
thank you.
Last thing, because I want to be respectful of your time.
Please.
Are there any... Because it's just this insane run of success you've had. Are there any failures that you had? What's the thing you thought that didn't work out the way I had hoped or wanted to, but it's ultimately led to something where you've learned a lesson from it?
Well, I think our biggest lesson became our first sort of I mean, there's numbers. I mean, you know, as an actor, I've done plenty of things that never saw the light of day or something. But on the writing side, it was actually in the beginning, and it ended well as far as Adopted. But Adopted was very different when we first wrote it. And I say this many times to people who ask, you know, you don't write all gold. You write, and every accomplished writer has a pile of things that are broken or not quite right, or they bailed on whatever reason. So, or something comes out that's very similar, that kind of thing. So we had written what would become Adopted, but it was very different. And so Nat and I put it up at the Groundlings, you know, as sort of a staged reading, you know, to sort of hear it. And it was mostly for friends or whatever. Nat had some friends at Fox, and they came. And it was horrible. Horrible. everything that you thought was so hilarious, you know, in your early days of your writing, I think you overwrite. There's so many lessons to be learned from the script. His friend from Fox basically said, and this was the time they were developing Arrested Development. And so it was very similar because it was very like posh family living, you know, almost in a country club. It's terrible. Didn't matter. The one thing she said was interesting was that my character was adopted. So then we took a step back and said, it is the only interesting thing in this thing. And then I told the story about my sister. And then that version, which has very little to do with what adopted, but many times, I think you write something and it's a disaster, but there's always something buried in there is great
that you can use later,
and then you use it and become something completely different. Right. So I think that was one of those things where you thought it's hilarious, and you put it up and you go, it's not hilarious, which we should know because we've done so many sketches there where you're like, this is hilarious, and then it bombs.
Well, that is every comedian that I've talked to says the same thing. You have to put it on its feet because it's, and that's what's so great about the multicam format is you have an audience there, and you go, we need to huddle,
might want to raise our bar,
you know, huddle a little bit, and that's why movies are so hard. Movie comedies are so hard because you can go deep down a rabbit hole of a joke thinking, man, I cannot wait
for people to see
this.
And
you're just nudging the guy next to you, watch, and it comes.
And yeah, and it's also
crickets.
Crickets. And then
trying to edit your way out of it.
Yeah. Why do we keep this thing? And we put him in the background in every area, and then people are going to be like, what's this story in the background? And I think, you know, improv is that touchy thing too, because you know, things that resonate on set, sometimes you're like, oh. It resonated because it was in the moment.
Right.
But not something in the moment anymore. It's out of context. So I think it's
that's great.
It's an interesting process.
Did you have as much fun on Bernard and Huey as it looked like you guys were having?
We did. I be honest with you, it was so, I mean, we shot that in 2 weeks, you know? And so you got a take, I think, sometimes. And then, you know, the director, as you can see in the movie, Dan Mirvish did a lot of, like, one setup. So we did a lot of three-page scenes where we would come in and out of frame.
Yeah.
It's creatively cool and a benefit and a great story. And it's fun for the actors because we're doing, like, these little mini theater moments. But, you know, you get three of those. And then for the edit bay, you got three choices.
Yeah.
Which one do we like best? Which one's Jim not that bad end?
Well, you guys are like two heavyweights just going at it, two masters of your craft.
That's
to hammer at each
amazing.
Other.
So great.
And I will say, for anybody who wants to make a low budget movie, they should watch this movie because the way he used the loft in that apartment, you going up and him going down, and you coming down when he's, you know, having sex with his co-worker, you're having sex with his daughter, all these, and the sound of that, and going up and down, and your frustration and leaving, coming back. It was masterful. It was really like Noises Off. It was a great way, if you're looking to do it where it feels like coverage, it's a really smart thing to look at.
It does. You can
I would encourage anybody to do it who wants to
change the planes.
It's great.
Exactly.
It's really great. Well, man, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Congratulations on everything.
Awesome.
And look forward to seeing what you're doing next, man.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Katie McEwen, Kirsten Woodward, and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.